The hour of 10:15 having arrived, I will call a joint meeting of the House Tax and House Property Tax Committees to order when we have a quorum. But we will get started with today's agenda. We're very fortunate today to have the folks from the Department of Revenue here. We have an overview of the Department of Revenue on energy producing systems. And the reason for this is we'll let them tell us what the reason is. Is Commissioner Bowerly in the House? Okay, I think that she'll be coming in a little bit here, but we'll start out. I have on the list here, I have Andrea Fish, Eric Willett, and Nathan Jessen, all from the department. So if you want to join us up front here. And I've been informed that Commissioner Bowerly will be stopping by, and so we'll rudely interrupt you in the middle of your testimony to allow the commissioner to make a few remarks. And we also have minutes that we will work on once we have a quorum. So welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please. And members, you should have in your packet the PowerPoint, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nathan Jessen, Tax Policy Research Specialist with the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the joint committee meeting.
Mr. Chair, Andrea Fish, also with the Property Tax Division of the Department of Revenue.
Welcome.
All right. And the reason we're here today is to discuss the study of energy producing systems the department reported on February 2nd of this year. The report was mandated last year during the 2014 legislative session. We were to outline the taxation of electric energy producing systems in Minnesota. The report was to evaluate the various energy producing systems, including both traditional and renewable energy sources. Also to look at available exclusions, exemptions, and payment in lieu of taxations that apply to the systems. The report was also to evaluate a number of different factors, including the property taxes per unit of energy produced in Minnesota compared to border states, alternative tax or fee systems for compensating host communities for the external costs that these energy facilities can place on them, and bearing in mind the solar energy production tax passed in 2014, the report was also to make recommendations for the taxation of solar energy producing systems. To achieve these outcomes, Revenue took on a number of steps, the first of which was conducting research on the taxation of energy systems, reviewing different national studies and incorporating those findings into the report. We also conferred with a working group of industry members, city and county officials, assessors, and legislative staff. We worked with that group to create a survey, which measured the that went out to cities and utilities to measure the costs and benefits of hosting these different utilities. We discussed taxation with neighboring states to look at the different methods which neighboring states tax and compensate host communities. On October 23rd, we toured a solar facility in Collegeville, Minnesota. The reason we went out there was to get a better sense of how these solar farms work and the kind of costs and benefits they can provide a community. We also hosted a meeting on October 31st with utilities, cities, and legislative staff to discuss the survey results, to get their feedback on if they thought any important data was missing from what we found, and to get any other recommendations they might have. And on November 21st, we hosted that same group again to share some of our preliminary results and to get any recommendations the working group might have on what they thought our study might find and get their feedback on that.
Mr. Jessen, if I could interrupt a second, hold that train of thought there. I'll officially call the joint meeting of the House Tax Committee and the House Property Tax Division to order, as we do have a quorum. Representative Simonson is so kind to move the minutes of February 10th. Any additions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing or seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. So Representative Simonson moved the minutes, but he was excused. But close enough for government work, I always say. Okay, so with that, we will continue. I believe we've had somewhat. Were you done, Mr. Jessen?
Yes, sir.
Perfect timing. How is that for timing? I almost felt like Karnak there for a second. Okay. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir. Thank you, Mr. Jessen, and you'll be around if we have questions of you.
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Ouellette, please state your name. I guess I just did, and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Eric Ouellette with the Department of Revenue. I'd like to go through at a very high level the main findings of the report, and then Ms. Fish and I will get into a little bit more detail. Mr. Jessen mentioned that we did a survey of costs and benefits of hosting these types of facilities, one of the things that we found in our literature review and through the survey is that many of the costs and benefits of hosting a facility are not quantifiable. So we could identify what sorts of costs and benefits that a community might face, but we were not able to put a dollar amount to a lot of them. We also found that a value-based property tax system, and in this case one that has a lot of exemptions, exclusions, and production tax elements, provides various levels of compensation to the host communities. So we were not able to conclude whether or not the property tax system accurately accounts for the unique and varying burdens imposed on host communities based on the types of facilities that they might have in their community. We're also unable to conclude whether the property tax system adequately compensates for current burdens, although we did find that the property tax system does not compensate, account for potential long-term costs of hosting these facilities. We also found that many of the host jurisdictions are very reliant on the compensation they receive from these facilities, and that these taxes have been unstable over time. In looking at other states, we found that the various tax approaches in neighboring states and in Minnesota have both positive and negative aspects. So there's pros and cons to the different approaches that different states take in terms of taxing these types of facilities. We also looked at the 2014 solar energy legislation, and we determined that it was the best option that we could review for how to tax solar energy systems. We were not able to do everything we hoped to do with the study. Some limitations we ran into is that we were unable to fully compare the taxation of energy production facilities in neighboring states. There's lots of comparative information in the report, but it wasn't quite as robust as we had hoped. We were also unable to gather greater detail and additional data on how the taxation of other industry non-energy producing facilities compares directly to energy producing facilities. Again, there's some information in the report, but not as much as we had hoped to achieve. We also did not identify non-property tax mechanisms for addressing the concerns of host communities. We kept our analysis to property tax and property tax related mechanisms. And with that, I will turn it over to Ms. Fish.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ouellette, and we'll wait for questions until we hear from Ms. Fish. Ms. Fish, please state your name for the record and who you represent, please.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. My name is Andrea Fish. I'm with the Department of Revenue's Property Tax Division. As Mr. Ouellette noted, one of our findings was that it's inconclusive whether our existing property tax system accurately accounts for the unique and varying burdens imposed on host communities by the presence of these energy facilities. In general, accuracy of a value-based property tax system is examined by comparing the level to which taxes of similar facilities account for burdens imposed on host communities. Within a perfectly accurate system, host communities would receive property tax income from their energy-producing facilities. The property tax income would parallel the costs of hosting the different facilities, and property taxes received would vary based on the different facility types and their different costs. In reality, the taxes paid by energy-producing facilities vary based on a number of things: the fuel type, the ownership structure, and whether the facility qualifies for special tax exemptions. This table summarizes the tax treatment of the various energy-producing facilities. It's something that's not necessarily accurate based on the costs of hosting the facilities. For example, you'll see that many utilities pay personal property tax, which most other industrial properties do not pay in Minnesota, even though they also impose different costs or burdens on their host communities. The result of our different policies is that the taxes paid per kilowatt hour can vary greatly based on the fuel type, and it's difficult to draw a correlation between the amount or type of energy produced and the taxes paid by the producing facility. You can see that biomass and hydroelectric pay some of the highest taxes per kilowatt hour, while coal and wind energy pay some of the lowest. This is particularly striking because coal and wind provide very different costs and benefits to the communities that host those energy facilities. Of the traditional fuels, in fact, coal pays the lowest in property taxes. A big part of this is the different components within the system that are designed to have these outcomes. The pollution control exemption is one of the reasons that coal facilities do pay the lowest taxes per kilowatt hour produced of the traditional fuel types. Beyond pollution control exemptions, we also provide personal property tax exemptions to specifically identified facilities. And there's a sliding scale market value exclusion that applies to certain facilities based on their efficiency. With that, I'll turn it back over to Mr. Ouellette to discuss the adequacy portion.
Mr. Ouellette.
Mr. Chair and members, so similar to the accuracy lens that we look through, we also look at adequacy. Are the revenues generated for the host community adequate to address the burdens imposed on the host community? And as I said at the outset, a lot of those costs that were identified we're not able to quantify. So the report doesn't say yes or no whether the revenues for a particular jurisdiction are adequate. But we did try to provide some information in terms of how to think about this this question of adequacy. So if you think of it in the ideal, a perfectly adequate system, the property taxes the host community receives would sufficiently cover the costs imposed on it by the energy producing facility. So as we mentioned, we did a survey as well as a literature review to identify the different types of costs and benefits that host communities may see. I'll first talk about the benefits. Some of the main benefits of identified of hosting an energy producing facility are high-skilled jobs, ancillary economic benefits, and the corporate citizenship of the utility companies who do good works in the community. There were additional benefits identified that were identified as being unique to the energy energy industry. The previous slide benefits could also apply to other large corporate taxpayers within a community. But those unique benefits that were identified were providing a stable source of electricity or lower cost utilities, the higher tax base due to the personal property tax that is particular to the energy producing facilities, as well as the environmental benefits of the mandated buffer areas that some of the larger facilities are required to maintain. On the cost side, the cost of hosting an energy producing facility, one of the ones that came up most frequently was pollution. Again, energy producing facilities are not the only industries that pollute, but that was one that was mentioned by many of the respondents. Also, development and land use limitations that may impact other development within the community, the need for additional emergency equipment, and the storage of waste or other byproducts. Some of the companies that responded also pointed out, however, that their efforts that they undertake to reduce some of these costs, for example, installing extra pollution control equipment to mitigate the pollution, or assisting or reimbursing local governments for some of the public safety or emergency training costs that they incur. There are also costs identified that are considered to be unique to the energy producing facilities, including long-term costs of cleanup and land reclamation, special public safety and emergency response costs, the potential for a catastrophic incident, and land development restrictions. Now again, these may exist with some other industries, but the respondents identified them as being particularly different or unique for hosting these types of facilities. The costs and benefits that were identified did vary based on the energy source, the facility size, and the ownership structure. For example, host communities with coal facilities were more likely to mention job creation and highly skilled workforce, as well as diversification of the tax base and lower taxes that are provided by hosting these facilities. nuclear facility hosts were more likely to identify development and land use restrictions and negative public perceptions, legacy issues, and the presence of the plant potentially being a deterrent to new businesses from entering the community. Smaller facilities were less likely to identify costs and benefits, leading to the idea that these smaller peaking facilities may not have as large of a presence in the community and garner as much attention or have as large of impacts on the community. And importantly, ownership structure matters as well. Municipal utilities don't pay the property taxes to the community, although many of them do make in lieu of payments to their local government, but they were less likely to identify costs, and they were more likely to identify things like lower cost utilities and reliable energy as being a benefit of having a municipal utility in the community. We also heard from the host communities that while the revenue source, the property taxes are very important to the host community, especially the hosts of the very large facilities. However, the dollars provided by many of these facilities have been declining over time. And this table shows all utility taxes, not just those from the large energy producing facilities, as a share of total property taxes paid statewide. And it's been in a slow decline for a number of decades. They not only identified the decline, they also identified the instability or unpredictability of the revenue source. And that unpredictability often comes from two main factors. One is the natural shifts in tax base. Homestead and agricultural property values have been growing at a much higher rate than utilities over much of that timeline. So the utilities have become a smaller share of the tax base in many communities just because other properties are increasing in value more quickly. But the other thing has to do with state policy changes. Class rate compression, that is the differential between the rates that business property pays and homestead property pays, that difference was compressed over a number of years in the 1990s through the 2001 tax reform, and that caused a lot of instability in the amount of utility revenues that these facilities generated. There also was a change in the rules, the state rules that govern how we value energy property that was undertaken by the department in 2007, and the new rules were phased in over a three-year period from 2008 to 2010, and those new rules had the effect of generally reducing the value of these facilities, sometimes by as much as a third. At this last slide just shows some of the communities that are most reliant on the taxes provided by the energy producing facilities. The top six communities in terms of their market value that comes from these facilities. The first column shows the total amount of their tax base from all utility property within the community. You'll see the city of Becker is number one at 66%. The second column shows the share of the tax base that comes from the personal property tax, which is unique to the energy producing facilities. And that also can be a very large share of these communities' tax base. So while the share has been declining and it has been somewhat unstable, it is still a very significant and important part of the revenues for these host communities. And with that, I'll turn it back to Ms. Fish.
Ms. Fish?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we undertook this study and we looked at our neighboring states to see what sort of mechanisms they had, we kept in mind the commonly understood sound tax principles, primarily understandability, efficiency, stability, and responsiveness to changes in the facility's output. While we didn't come up with any alternative mechanisms that we would like to recommend, we did find some of the positive and negative attributes within each of the different systems. We primarily noticed a trade-off between stability as a source of property tax income for the host community and responsiveness to changes of a facility's output. Value-based taxes that we have in Minnesota and that there are some components of in Iowa, Michigan, North Dakota, and South Dakota can be applied to the real and or the personal property. And these may be a more stable source of taxes for the host communities that rely on them, but they can be more complicated and difficult to understand, as I know many of you have appreciated. And because of that, they're more expensive to administer due to those complications. Production taxes, on the other hand, that we have in Minnesota and that there are also components of in North Dakota and South Dakota, in Minnesota on solar and wind facilities, are more efficient to administer. They're simpler to calculate, they're more responsive to changes in the facility's use, and are more understandable to the taxpayers. On the flip side of that, it allows the facility more control over their taxes, which is a good thing, but it's inconclusive then that it's a stable source of taxes for a host community. There is a component of capacity taxes in North Dakota, and this is based on a facility's capacity rather than energy output, so the size of the facility is an easy way of explaining that one. This can also be more stable than production taxes because it's based on something that does not change, and it's easier to understand, but again, not responsive to changes in facility output. Additionally, Iowa has a non-property tax, an excise tax, on their energy that is another possibility. We weren't able to look too far into the non-property tax taxation. And Wisconsin does not have a taxation necessarily, but a licensing fee in lieu of taxation in many cases. As we discussed earlier, we did find under the taxation of solar energy producing systems that last year's legislation was the best option for taxation of solar energy facilities. Last year's changes were under three major parts. The first was clarifying that the solar energy generating systems are exempt from taxation. Used to be limited to photovoltaic devices, which is not a word that used to be in my vocabulary. The solar energy generating systems are exempt under current statute, and this mirrors the same exemption for wind energy facilities. It also created a solar energy production tax. And again, some of the benefits of a production tax are that it's understandable, simple and efficient to administer, responsive to changes in the energy produced, and again, it mirrors the taxation of another renewable energy source, that being wind. Finally, last year's legislation clarified the classification of property used primarily for solar energy production, where if a property is primarily used for solar energy production, it's classified as industrial property. This allows assessors to identify the primary use of the property and maintain an equitable tax system. Our specific recommendations in the report are to maintain the solar energy production tax as it was identified as the best option. We also had a recommendation to update the criteria for combining nameplate capacities for wind energy conversion systems. This is a change that would just make the wind energy production tax mimic the solar energy production tax and have them be the same so that they can reasonably account for the size and output of a wind energy system. And finally, maintaining a property tax classification that's reflective of property used primarily for energy production. As far as my presentation and Mr. Ouellette's, we're done. We can stand for any questions. And we also sincerely want to thank you for the opportunity to present this report, as well as all of the industry experts and local government officials, members of our division who helped us really flesh out this report.
Thank you. Mr. Justin, maybe you could join us here. We'll go to member questions, but first of all, a question. Is there anyone in the audience that would wish to make comments on this report? Anyone that's driven over 50 miles? Okay, thank you. So we'll be going to member questions here. First of all, is it safe to I think Mr. Ouellette mentioned that coal plants pay the lowest property tax, but do they also pay a personal property, or they do they also pay a personal property tax? Is that factored in, Mr. Ouellette?
Mr. Chair and members, the figure included the personal property tax, and that is the tax per kilowatt hour generated. In terms of total dollars, they pay among the most tax because there's some very large coal facilities. But in terms of the amount of tax they pay per amount of kilowatt hour generated, they are the lowest of the fuel types.
Okay, Mr. Ouellette or Ms. Fish or Mr. Justin, would it be fair to say that how many coal plants do we have in Minnesota right now?
I think there's maybe six.
There are 18. There are 18 coal-fired energy facilities in Minnesota.
Okay, so since there are coal-fired energy facilities, you're 66% off, whatever. close enough. Is it fair to say that every one of those coal plants pays the same property tax, same personal property tax rate in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, members, no, that's not the case. One of the main things that we found was that there are these special exclusions and exemptions that apply to some facilities but not to others, and also depending on the value of the system that they're in, they may be valued differently. So one of our main findings was that there wasn't really a consistency between facilities as well as among fuel types.
Interesting. Okay, Ansels, Earhart, Draskowski. Representative Ansels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to either of the testifiers. My question has to do with the storage of spent nuclear fuel and host communities. As many of you know, the host community for storage of spent nuclear fuel in these caskets is the Prairie Island Indian community. And I'm just wondering how it can be that the tax rate for the Prairie Island facility is less than it is for the Monticello facility. And secondly, and most importantly, this storage is tantamount to a permanent storage repository for spent nuclear fuel, and I'm wondering if our system allows for special adjustments to the host community for being the host to spent nuclear fuel.
Mr. Ouellette?
Mr. Chair and members, on the first question about the variation, that is the tax per kilowatt hour generated, and in any particular year, maybe one of the facilities had refueling that year and the other one didn't, so they're roughly the same when they're running at full capacity. In terms of the property tax really does not acknowledge the long-term storage issues. There are federal laws that govern that, and the company is required to have some money set aside for that, but there are obviously a lot of open questions about how what the permanent answer is for dealing with the spent nuclear waste, but the property tax system doesn't really directly address it at all.
Representative Ansel?
Thank you. It's fine. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Chair Earhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I got a couple questions here. That stipend that we're sending to Washington for permanent storage is no longer being done, so that's not in the... You don't know that. Maybe that's another committee or another...
We don't know.
Mr. Ouellette?
Okay.
Mr. Chair, that's kind of outside of our wheelhouse. I don't
know. Well, I was wondering if that's...
Chair Earhart?
Mr. Chairman, if that's still included in what we're charging the public, and it's passing through to some of your figures here, but... Okay. On the decline in as a share of the total utility taxes here on page 7, public utility share of property taxes declining. Why can you succinctly again? Maybe you said it several times. Why? What's the reason for that,
Mr. Ouellette?
Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart. There's a couple of different reasons for that. One of them is that over this time period, other property values increased more than utility values, so utilities became a smaller share of the total, especially in Greater Minnesota, the run-up in agricultural values as well as homestead values statewide. The other reason, though, that's more directly has to do with utilities is some of the state policy changes that have been made in that time period. The compression of the property tax class rates, reducing the commercial industrial utility class rates throughout the 1990s had a big part to do with that, as well as the rule change that I mentioned that the department undertook in 2007 changed how we valued utility property, and that resulted in an overall net reduction in utility values. It was phased in over a number of years.
Chair Earhart?
Thank you.
Chair Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ouellette and Ms. Fish, so the recommendations are to that the best approach is to provide exemptions like we did for wind and solar, and then provide this this production tax in lieu of it. Can you explain why that's the recommendation? Why is that the better approach? And does that recommendation also include, should we extend that approach to the other types of energy?
Ms. Fish?
Mr. Chair, Representative Roskowski, the recommendations that we had for solar to maintain last year's legislation was specific to solar. It wasn't a recommendation that we extended to other fuel types. We believe that it was most consistent with the existing production tax for wind energy, which is mirrored because it is a renewable fuel source. And there are advantages to a production tax in its efficiency, the simplicity of administration, the ability of property owners to have control over the taxes that they pay by adjusting their production levels. We also agreed with the classification clarification for that. Solar energy does require greater land use than wind energy, and wind energy does not account for the classification because of the land use, whereas the solar energy does say if property is primarily used for solar, it should be classified as industrial because there is no other option for the land use underneath it.
Mr. Chair Dreskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Fish, why wouldn't we extend it then to the other energy types? Why is it, if it works well and it's the best form for these two, you would think that it would similarly work better in terms of those scalabilities for production, et cetera, and their facilities like you talked. Can you comment on that?
Ms. Fish, why?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's an excellent question. One of the big things that we came across with solar and wind was within our discussions with the host communities, solar being at a disadvantage because it's so new, that the cost that we had heard from the communities, in order to account for the different costs of the presence of a large facility, it's very different with solar where it doesn't have the same level of need for community services to those solar facilities. We did not, based on our research as well as our research of neighboring states, find that a production tax for other fuel types would provide any greater benefit than the system we have in place.
Chair Dreskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what I think I heard, Ms. Fish, maybe help me out, is that these solar energy facilities wouldn't have been able to afford to land there if we hadn't taken this different approach.
Ms. Fish?
Mr. Chair, that wasn't a direct item that we looked into or studied, whether the property tax had any effect on the outcomes in terms of solar energy facilities being created in Minnesota.
Chair Dreskowski.
An unrelated question, Mr. Chair, if I could. Mr. Ouellette, Ms. Fish, you were talking about the department rules for valuing the energy facilities. And did you say 2007, I think? Did those rules, and were those rules developed to apply equally to different energy types?
Mr. Ouellette.
Mr. Chair and members, there are separate rules governing some of how investor-owned utilities are valued versus other energy types like wind and solar, but the rule does encompass all of our utility value, all of our unitary valuation, which is all the big energy companies. So yeah, it does cover them.
Chair Dreskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Fish and Mr. Ouellette.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a question on the host communities, the benefits that they receive from having an energy facility there, and I noticed that one was Hoyt Lakes, and it's a pretty substantial portion of their municipal levy that the power plant there pays, and it sounds like it's based on what sort of fuel is used, so if and when it converts from coal to natural gas, will there be a decrease in the benefit to the local community?
I don't think anybody wants that one.
Mr. Chair and Representative
Mr. Ouellette.
Mr. Chair and Representative Moline, I don't know off the top of my head whether a conversion would reduce the value of the facility. I'm looking for help from an expert. Yes?
Mr. Cummings, could you come back?
I got a nod from another colleague that it probably will reduce the value of the property when it's converted from coal to natural gas.
Representative Moline?
Mr. Chair, and then I guess to the department, if you could maybe get me some sort of estimate on, you know, if you're able to tell what the decrease would be to the city of Hoyt Lakes when that conversion is finalized. Thank you.
Mr. Ouellette, can you follow up with that?
We will,
please, Mr. Chair. Okay, Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, response to Chair Drazkowski's question about the solar, production tax that was put in place last year. Part of the rationale of that was to provide additional revenue to communities, to the schools, to the city, to the county, to the township, that was stable in its work. And then just also remind you, in terms of the lower impact, as people say, a solar spill is called a nice summer day. Very different than, say, an oil spill. To the question of value of estimating the cost impact of hosting a energy facility, did you look, I'm thinking particularly the coal plants, at any impact on health in the area, or which could be a larger area than simply the host community? And then I know particularly, again, with coal, there can be some significant transportation impacts. Obviously, we're having a lot of problems with the cost of transportation and oil, and the impact on communities as well. Were those costs a part of the study? Mr. Ouellette, I assume?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dabney, we did see, we certainly saw mention of those costs in the literature that we reviewed, but we didn't find any way to quantify them ourselves. We do have information in the report about the levels of pollution that different fuel types generally, the output that they have. There's a really good federal data source for that. But what the health outcomes are because of those pollutants and how those might compare to other industry, we weren't able to quantify that.
Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Ouellette. And shifting to a different power source and a different concern about the valuation of nuclear facilities, particularly concerned about the Monticello plant. They recently did a significant remodeling with dramatic cost overruns. And it's really clear that because of Xcel, the lights were on at headquarters, but it's not clear that anybody was home in making decisions on following the costs of that upgrade. Will the full cost of that upgrade be reflected in the valuation of the Monticello plant? I know that Xcel is trying to push the cost of the overruns onto ratepayers. Will they be paying for the full cost of the overruns on their property taxes in the valuation?
Mr. Ouellette?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dabney, the cost of upgrades is one of many factors that goes into the valuation of the entire company. So it may have an impact, but when we do unitary valuation, we do an income approach, a cost approach, and the third one.
Income.
And on the market approach, thank you. So there's lots of factors. Certainly, the real costs incurred by Xcel will have to be made up either through rates or through reduced profits. But that was outside of the scope of what we analyzed, and the company might be in a better position to answer that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Ouellette. Thank you, Ms. Fish.
I have one more member on the list, and it'll be my intention then to go into the Office of Legislative Auditor report after that. But please, if any members have questions on these issues, please visit with Mr. Ouellette, Ms. Fisher, Mr. Jessen. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to clarify on the coal, I'm curious as to how many of the small muni coal plants are decommissioned or in the process of decommissioning?
Mr. Ouellette?
Mr. Chair and members, I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. The one that is idle but still paying property taxes that I'm aware of is in Granite Falls. It's an NSP plant, but I'm not sure if that's coal or...
Yeah.
I'm not sure. We'll have to get back to you on that. I'm sorry.
No problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that I saw your map in one of the reports, and it indicated some locations that actually have already been decommissioned. And so I didn't know if that was updated. And then just a side thing on your page 30 with the wind energy, that's not Blue Earth County in between Freeborn and Martin. So maybe you could verify that. But getting back to the discussion on the solar and wind, base plate versus max capability, because there were some concerns where they were having peaks that exceeded the base plate. If there was any look at that, because that does make a difference if they're close to that transition between sizes. And then what type of derating data do you have on wind and coal base plate to actual production, since you are getting reports for tax purposes? I would assume you'd have both bits of data, so it'd be nice to understand that.
Mr. Willett?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, on the second question, we do have in the report summary data anyway on both capacity and production by fuel type, but we do have that for each facility in our own data, so if you'd like to see that, we can share that with you. On the first issue about, I believe the qualification for the rate for the production tax is based on nameplate, so I think if there is a facility that's nameplate is under the threshold, but it has actual production over, that it would not get picked up by the production tax, and I'll let you know if that's incorrect. That's my understanding.
Okay, thank you very much. And Representative Swedzinski. Okay. If anyone has questions of the three witnesses, please feel free to contact them at a future time. With that, I'd like to bring Commissioner Bowerly down for just a second. Time's up.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members.
Commissioner Bowerly, welcome to the Tax Committee. And if your nose was itching yesterday, we were talking about you. And I would just like to, on behalf of the committee, I'd like to thank you for your quick and decisive action of the last weekend regarding the situation with TurboTax. I don't know if you have a quick update on that, if you could, for the committee.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I did receive the report from Deputy Cummings, as you would expect. And I do want to, I appreciate that so much, and I, of course, pass that along to the great team at Revenue who really pulled together and worked around the clock. Senior leadership of our office was on the phone with Intuit at the parent company of TurboTax at 2 a.m. And literally around the clock for a number of days. We recognize that this was a significant disruption for Minnesotans and many of your constituents, and we did not take the step lightly to close our system to TurboTax filings, but the situation was one where we were concerned about the potential for fraudulent returns coming into our system, and of course, you know, that impacts both taxpayers and the general fund, and so to protect Minnesota's system and Minnesota taxpayers, we did take that step. After Intuit announced that it had taken new targeted security measures, including multi-factor authentication, we were able to open our system. As you will know, as experts on the tax system, the work is not done on our part. We have to review these returns to make sure that, to the extent there was potential fraudulent activity in them, that we identify it to protect Minnesotans who want to legitimately file their taxes. So that is the work on our end. Minnesotans should know that electronic filing is the best way to file your taxes, and there's information about vendors on our website, and we look forward to hopefully a smoother filing season going forward. We are in constant contact with Intuit and all of our vendors about any issues that they see. For your, you may have already seen this morning some news about the FBI is investigating this set of fraudulent activity, so we're aware of that, and of course, we'll cooperate with any federal investigation if they need any information about what we saw here in Minnesota. But we are back to normal, as we say, and we do appreciate your understanding and your patience. And if you have any constituents who have concerns, please have them give us a call. We have information on our website. Again, customers who did file don't need to do anything. We will review their returns, and if we see any issues, we will contact them.
Okay, thank you. And again, thank you for your quick action. That one kind of scared me, if you will. I thought, you know, it may have been a situation where when I filed my tax returns, the state got such a large check that it might have crashed the system. I wasn't sure. But thankfully, that didn't happen. Okay, with that being said, thank you very much for your efforts. We appreciate that. And thank you to Mr. Jetson, Ms. Fish, and Mr. Ouellette for your review of the report. We really appreciate that. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Okay, item next, we are very fortunate today to have Mr. Nobles of the Office of Legislative Auditor with us, and a Carrie Meyerhoff and a Dave Zametta. Did I do that right?
Yes.
Zametta?
Yes.
That's good. Oh, that's okay. If maybe get you all three up here. Oh, you're... Okay, very good. First of all, before we get started, is there anyone in the audience that's driven over 50 miles that would like to make any comments on the Office of Legislative Auditor's report? Okay, seeing none, I will turn it over. We're very fortunate today to have with us Mr. Nobles from the... Is it Nobles or Noble?
Nobles, like the county, Mr.
With the S?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Michael. Yeah, okay. Okay. I got that right. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir, and present your report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, joint committee. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me is Carrie Meyerhoff, was the manager of this evaluation. And Mr. Chairman and members, we do thank you very much for the invitation to be with you today. We appreciate your interest in this report. As you may know, we issued the report in November of 2013. But we still think it contains findings and recommendations that deserve further consideration. So again, we appreciate you giving us this opportunity this morning. I think we would all say that the forests of our state are one of our most important resources. Important for the economy, for recreational activities, and for the environment. But sometimes we have struggled in this state to find the right balance between our short-term economic and recreational needs and the need to protect and preserve our forests for the long term. To help us strike that appropriate balance, the state has adopted the idea of sustained forest management, both for the management of the forests that are owned and managed by the state. And in 2001, the legislature adopted the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act to try to encourage private landowners to also manage their forest in a sustainable way. So the idea, obviously, of sustainable management of our forest is a very clear-eyed, common-sense concept. So I think some people were probably surprised when the Office of the Legislative Auditor issued a report that was critical of the state Sustainable Forest Incentive Act and program. To be clear, we are not criticizing the concept. Again, it's clear-eyed, it's a good concept. Rather, we question whether this particular tool, the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act, has been designed and implemented in a way that ensures measurable results. And we say that in part because we found that the incentive payments made to landowners are not clearly aligned with specific program objectives or goals. For example, while payments are an implicit acknowledgement that property taxes may be a disincentive to sustainable forest management, the amount of an incentive payment is not tied to the amount of property tax that the taxpayer, the landowner, pays. In addition, the program requires very little assurance that people who are participating and receiving payments actually comply with the program's requirements. So, Mr. Chairman, we've raised some questions about this very well-intentioned program, and we again appreciate the attention that you're giving to it, and I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Meyerhoff to give you more details on our findings and recommendations.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Carrie Meyerhoff with the Legislative Auditor's Office, and I'd also like to acknowledge my co-worker, Catherine Reed, who worked with me on this evaluation and is seated behind me. I'm going to start with some background information and descriptive information about this program before getting into our detailed findings and recommendations. The legislature created the Sustainable Forest Incentive Program in 2001. You all passed the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act after commissioning a study to look at the issue of taxation of forest land in Minnesota. The Sustainable Forest Incentive Act created a program that is administered by the Department of Revenue with a smaller role for the Department of Natural Resources. The program provides an annual per acre payment to participating landowners. It's currently $7 per acre. And between 2003, when the first payments were made, and 2013, when we did our evaluation, the state had made $44 million in payments to participating landowners. The payments are funded by an open appropriation from the general fund. And the purpose of this program, as stated in statute, is to encourage a long-term commitment to sustainable forest management. Now, sustainable forest management does not dictate a particular outcome for forest land, but it acknowledges that there are environmental, economic, and recreational benefits to forest land. But sustainable forest management does require an informed and active management of land to try and achieve those objectives. As this graphic shows, from 2003 through 2013, the red line indicates that the number of participants in the program has increased each year. The yellow bars in this graphic show that the number of acres enrolled in the program also increased each year through 2011 before dropping in 2012 and again in 2013. In 2013, there were approximately 2,300 participating landowners receiving payments for about 738,000 acres of forest land. Most participants enrolled in the program have 160 acres or less enrolled in the program. The median participant has 120 acres enrolled in the program. But there's quite a range. In 2012, it ranged from 20 acres to 185,000 acres enrolled in the program. Now, as this slide shows, less than one-half of 1% of landowners have over 1,920 acres enrolled in the program, but they account for 48% of the enrolled acres. And I'll explain the relevance of that a little bit later. As is probably not surprising, most of the enrolled acres are in northern Minnesota, which is where most of our forest land is. Almost half of the acres are in Coochiching and Itasca counties. St. Louis County has another 90,000 acres enrolled in the program. Most of the counties without any acreage enrolled in the program are in western and southern Minnesota and the seven-county metropolitan area. So before a landowner can participate in this program, there are several requirements that they must meet. And I'd like to go over those now. At first, they have to enroll at least 20 contiguous acres, and at least half of those acres need to meet a particular definition of forest land. And there are certain things that none of the acres can be. They cannot be agricultural use, residential use. They cannot be classified as 2C managed forest land. And there are some other restrictions that apply to the acres enrolled in the program. Participants must also obtain what's called a forest management plan for their enrolled acres. It must have been written in the previous 10 years by a plan writer who was approved by the Department of Natural Resources. And approval is based on meeting certain educational and experience requirements. And there are also requirements for what those plans contain. They have to identify the landowner objectives, and they have to include recommended activities to help the landowner achieve those objectives. And those recommended activities have to be consistent with the state's voluntary timber harvest and forest management guidelines, which emphasize sustainability. Continuing with program requirements, participants have to have a covenant on their enrolled land, which restricts development for a minimum of 8 years. They have to, if they're a large landowner, and that's over 1,920 acres, they have to allow public access. And so that's where the less than half of 1% of owners fit this category, but they have about 48% of the acres enrolled in the program. Participants have to submit an application that includes evidence that they are current with their property taxes, that they have filed a covenant, and that they do have a forest management plan. And then to continue participating in the program each year and receive their annual incentive payment, they have to return an attestation to the Department of Revenue saying that they're complying with all the requirements of the program and that they continue to comply with all the program's requirements. And so when we look at sort of the history of where this program came from, and what it requires, and how it's administered, we identified really four goals that can be attributed to this program. First, it provides some sort of property tax relief to owners of forest land. It encourages sustainable forest management by private forest landowners. Preventing parcelization and development is another goal of this program. And then finally, to secure public access to large tracts of private forest land. And so we looked at how the program's design and administration supports those different goals. And we found that the incentive payment is not tied to property taxes, and it's not tied to any of the other possible goals of the program. So regardless of the activities a landowner undertakes on their forest land, regardless of whether or not they're providing public access to their forest land, regardless of the property taxes they're paying on the forest land, they're receiving $7 per acre. So we looked at a small sample of people enrolled in the program, and we estimated what their payment would be for 2013 and what their property taxes would be for 2013. And you can see from this table that the range in their property taxes that is offset by the incentive payment ranges from under 25% to over 100%, with about 30% of those individuals receiving a payment that exceeded the property taxes that they paid for that enrolled land. We also found that the covenant's effect on preventing parcelization and development is unclear. So the covenant is binding for a minimum of 8 years, but there's nothing about the covenant that prevents a participating landowner from parcelizing and selling parts of their forest land to other landowners. And county assessors have found violations of the covenant, such as new structures or developments on land that is enrolled in the program. Now, we fully admit that there were very few confirmed violations of the program. And they could be the only ones, but we think that's unlikely because the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act requires very little oversight and has very few mechanisms to ensure compliance by participating landowners. So the annual attestation that participating landowners have to return to the Department of Revenue is the chief mechanism of overseeing compliance with this program. The Department of Revenue has taken an additional step by asking county assessors to check enrolled parcels for violations and letting the Department of Revenue know if they find any violations, but there's nothing in the act that requires county assessors to do this. And the attention that assessors pay to this is really varies. So, for example, one of the county assessors had spent a couple weeks with her staff looking at every one of the 500-plus parcels enrolled in the program and finding potential violations, where another county assessor would just check to make sure they weren't classified as 2C managed forest land, which is only one of the possible problems that a participating landowner might have. And then we are also concerned that the forest management plans are not reviewed to ensure that they are that they meet the requirements in that the Department of Natural Resources has established for the forest management plans, that they're up to date, that the activities included in them are consistent with sustainable forest management. They're just not reviewed. And then the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act does not adequately address the issues raised by subsequent landowners. So since as I mentioned, participating landowners can parcelize and sell their land to other people. And they have to let the Department of Revenue know they no longer own the acres, so they don't get the incentive payments, but they don't have to inform the Department of Revenue who they sold the acres to. The new landowners don't need to apply to the program. So it's possible that there could be people who have acres that are bound by a covenant that the Department of Revenue doesn't even know exist. So they wouldn't be getting the letter, the annual attestation that they have to return to the department. Those acres would not be included in the list that is sent to county assessors. There's really no way to monitor people who might be owning land that are still bound by this covenant. In addition, subsequent landowners are not required to meet the conditions to apply to the program as first-time owners are. So, for example, they don't need to get their own management plan. And there's no checking to make sure that the land that they purchased actually meets the definition of forest land for the purposes of this program, or that the original landowner, the land they continue to hold, meets those definitions. And finally, we concluded that the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act's penalty provisions are too limited. Right now, the one penalty provision is that violators can be fined 4 years of payments they received plus interest. But they might not have, like if it's a subsequent landowner, they might not have enrolled in the program. They might have not received any payments, and they might build a cabin on their land, and there's really no mechanism to penalize them for violating the covenant that restricts development. The penalty provision also doesn't differentiate among violators. So, for example, there might be an interest in someone who's cleared the forest land and built a cabin. You might want to penalize them differently than someone who enrolled in or had their land classified as 2C managed forest land. You know, they're still managing it sustainably, but they enrolled in a program they really shouldn't have if they were already in this one. You might want to differentiate between different types of penalties with the kind of penalty you impose upon them. And then finally, the penalty provision right now includes removing the enrolled land from the program. So it's still bound by the covenant, but the landowner can no longer get the payments. And again, depending on how the landowner, the participating landowner violates the requirements of the program, you might not want to kick them out. You know, there might be an opportunity to work with them to help them learn how to better manage their forest land. You might want to keep them in the program if your real goal is to encourage sustainable forest management. And so, turning to our recommendations, we recommend, first of all, that the legislature either tie the incentive payments more clearly to the goals of the program or eliminate the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act, repeal the act. We did not make a specific recommendation about how to tie the payment to the goals. We really wanted that to start a conversation, and I understand that that has been happening. If the legislature does choose to repeal the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act, as Mr. Noble said, we were not disagreeing with the implied goals of this program. We would suggest trying to achieve those goals through other mechanisms that either already exist or creating different programs specifically targeted to the different goals. Now, we expect that repealing the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act would not be popular, so we also made suggestions for how to improve the program if it's retained. We think that the forest management plans should be registered with the Department of Natural Resources, and the responsibility for determining whether the enrolled land actually meets the definition of forest land would shift from the Department of Revenue to the Department of Natural Resources. So the Department of Revenue can be verifying tax-related things, but the Department of Natural Resources would be verifying whether the land is actually forest land. And they could also be making sure that the plans meet requirements and statutes and are up to date. We also recommend some kind of increased verification of ongoing compliance. It could be a sample of landowners. It could be a sample of tax parcels. Again, didn't really specify how this should be accomplished because it would require more resources, obviously. But we do think that the program needs more oversight. We recommend clarifying and expanding the penalty provisions to address some of those concerns I mentioned earlier in terms of not being able to differentiate among types of violations, and in some cases there not being a real clear penalty for violations. And finally, to to amend the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act to address some of those issues I listed having to do with subsequent owners of enrolled land. And with that, I can conclude my comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Meyerhoff. Questions for members, Representative Ansells?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I don't want to get us too far in the weeds or the woods, but you touched on violations. Aren't most of the violations hunting shacks, and doesn't that whole phenomena comport with the public access and multiple use that we have traditionally had in northern Minnesota?
Ms. Meyerhoff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Ansells. I don't know if most of them have been hunting shacks. One thing that people who want to participate in the program can do is withhold up to 3 acres from enrollment in the program for structures, and so that they're supposed to only enroll the part that doesn't have the structures on it. Right now, the kind of structures that are allowed are those that are related to managing the forest land. But there have been findings of houses and cabins and a gravel pit and other things on enrolled land that I think would go beyond a hunting shack.
Just a brief follow-up. What would a structure that is related to the management of the forest land be?
Ms. Meyerhoff?
In the real world.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I honestly don't know, but I would imagine it might.
This committee has never questioned your honesty.
It might have equipment in it, like a tool, a shed with equipment in it or something.
I'm too far in the woods, I think.
Better get back out of the woods, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ansells. Chair Hackbarth.
I'll pass.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the discussion about possible issues for new purchasers, I would think that the covenant would show up in a title search, but I do see that there could be issues where to qualify you need to have at least half being forested and 20 contiguous acres. So if you had 80 acres, you could have 20 acres that then somebody could buy that's pasture land, isn't forested. Are they underneath the covenant?
Ms. Meyerhoff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Quam. So if all those 80 acres were enrolled in the program, they would be covered by the covenant. If the landowner sold the pasture land piece of it, whatever isn't forest land, to somebody else, that new owner, that land is still covered by the covenant. That person could choose to enroll in the program as long as there's at least 20 acres. And that was kind of the point where, well, maybe their land doesn't meet the definition of forest land. Maybe they shouldn't be in the program, but that's not checked right now.
Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My other question was, in your sampling, you show approximately a third that are getting payments in excess of 100% of property taxes. Are there any breakdown of demographics or characteristics of that group by size of parcel in the program, location in the state, relationship to organizations or people?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Quam. If I can direct your attention to page 17 of the report, we at least broke it down by county. So it doesn't have the individuals and the number of acres they had enrolled, but you can see that in some counties, the middle column is the percent where it exceeded the property taxes. So like in Cook, Kitson, and Coochiching County, all of the enrolled acres, the payments exceeded the property taxes, whereas in others it was...
Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And some of the questions I had have been asked by others, and I appreciate that. But why do we pay people to in a forest preservation program for land that isn't forest?
Ms. Meyerhoff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Davney. I can only speculate. Because...
please do.
The rest of us do, right, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
You might have a big chunk of land that's not just, it's not like all forest up here, and then all of this is clearly some other type of land, and down here is something else. It kind of mixed, it kind of can be mixed up. And so it's 20 contiguous acres, at least half of which is forested, and that has a particular meaning. But it might all be all intertwined. That is all I...
Chair Dabney?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yeah, because I was starting to think if I just put another tree in the backyard, you know, I'd apply. Because especially if I can get over 100% of my property taxes back, this is looking like a good deal. A larger question that I'm wondering.
Chair, do you have 20 acres in Minneapolis?
Fair point. Fair point.
No.
I don't.
Okay.
And it would take, I think, a large number of my neighbors to get to 20 acres. I'm a city kid. I don't think in terms of acres. It's always been a challenge for me. You know, it's a unit, you know, it's like drams. I don't think in terms of drams either.
Is that about the size of Rip and Wofford's district?
Pretty close,
probably.
Mr. Chair, larger question for the Legislative Auditor's Office. Why is this a property tax program? It seems to me, while I understand it's structured to offset property taxes, particularly when you exceed 100% of the property taxes, it doesn't seem like it's much of a property tax program any longer. It seems like it's an incentive program, you know, for all the good reasons stated early in your report, but that it may not be appropriately situated in the property tax area. Did you engage that question at all in your research?
Mr. Noble. Chairman and members, you know, one of the issues that we talked a lot about to the Department of Revenue and the Department of Natural Resources is how did this program end up being a property tax program administered by the Department of Revenue? Because that is one of the shortcomings that results in oversight. Why isn't there more involvement by the Department of Natural Resources? We think there should be, as reflected in our recommendations. I think some of the answer to your question is in the history of how this act got put in the law. Our understanding is that historically it came through the tax committee. And was not reviewed through the Natural Resource Committee. We think there should be more involvement of natural resources. It is a natural resource program. So that's the best we can do. I think it's a bit of history in where and how the program got started.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. Chair Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but this is maybe a question more for the Department of Revenue, but I will ask it of the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Were you, and you must have, but have you seen a breakdown by county of the number of specific parcels that are in this program?
Mr. Noble or Ms. Meyerhoff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson. We don't have the number of parcels. We have the number of acres, which is in the report. But maybe I don't know if someone from the department would.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. The map that you've provided us on page 5 of the PowerPoint, you know, shows the areas by the color coding of more than 50,000 acres, and then down to none. But when you were doing the report, did you actually have a breakdown by county so that you could review this?
Ms. Meyerhoff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson. On page 12, if I can direct you to page 12 of the evaluation, that includes the number of acres in each county.
Oh, thank you.
I don't know about tax parcels.
That's okay. And then, Mr. Chair, first of all, does this land have to be part of the property tax system before an applicant can apply to put it in this program? In other words, they have to be paying property taxes on it first before it can qualify.
Ms. Meyerhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson. That's the way it has been administered. It can't be tax exempt, if that's what you're asking.
Yes, thank you.
Chair Erickson.
That's good.
Okay. Got a couple more for questions. I don't want to cut any members off, but after these next two questions or members, I'll be going to Mr. Zumeta, and then we'll go with questions after that. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Nobles. I'm just still trying to understand exactly how this works, and, you know, the penalties are pretty weak, but the Star Tribune has done a pretty dramatic kind of series of articles about a part of our state up in the northwest area where you can see some pretty dramatic, just, you know, total clear-cutting of really rich and wonderful forests to plant potato farms, which are now threatening the water supplies of that whole area, and so there's been some real controversy about it. If those lands were enrolled in this program, what were the property owners required to do in terms of notifying that it was no longer there? What's the penalty if they don't? Is there a clawback of the property tax benefits if they fail to report? You know, how does this program interact if those forest lands were enrolled?
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Loeffler, I think, you know, without addressing every detail, I think the central question you raise, will this program, as administered, prevent a forested area from being converted into potato farms? And the answer to that is no. And that's why we say, we need to begin by asking, what are we trying to accomplish? And is this tool doing it? And there are a variety of weaknesses, but fundamentally, it's a temporary enrollment. And so I think, even for those people, and I've talked a good deal with legislators from that part of the state, Senator Saxhog in particular, I don't think he minds me mentioning that, who has a great deal of concern about the converting of forest land to that kind of usage for a variety of reasons. And I think he welcomes this report as really raising the fundamental question, is this an effective tool? And or do we need to look for other mechanisms? If in fact, it is the will of the legislature and the people of the state to keep forested land from being converted to potato fields or something else, that's a policy choice that you need to make. There's some people that probably would advocate for that kind of conversion for a variety of reasons, but if it's your choice to not allow that to happen, this is a pretty ineffective way to do it.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you.
Chair Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Meyerhoff, could you just review the procedure for withdrawing land from the program?
Ms. Meyerhoff?
If there is one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson.
How do we make it a potato farm?
So the way it's supposed to happen is once you have been enrolled in the program for 4 years, you can request to get out of it, and then you have to wait 4 years until you're released from the program. So if you were enrolled in the program and you changed your mind, you would notify the Department of Revenue, and then 4 years later they would send you something releasing you from the obligation to continue to honor the covenant. You would no longer be getting payments. That's how you get out of it. That's how you're supposed to get out of it, I should say.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson. We'll now go to Mr. Zumeta, then we'll go back to questions. I couldn't see you behind there. I don't want to forget about you. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please. And then I have starting questions. We represent Earhart first.
Mr. Chair,
Zumeta.
Representatives, my name is David Zumeta. I serve as Executive Director of the Minnesota Forest Resources Council, which is a state council that was created by the legislature in 1995 to advise the governor, the legislature, and public agencies on sustainable forest policies and practices. Please note that there's two relevant handouts that you should have received. One of them is a letter that I sent to Representative Dill and Senator Saxhog. It's dated January 13th, 2015. It's directly relevant to what I'm going to say. And also, that letter accompanied a report. It's the SFIA, or Sustainable Forest Incentive Act, stakeholder report dated January 12, 2015. So I'll be referring to those two items. As you just heard, the Legislative Auditor's SFIA evaluation report outlined a number of areas of concern, as well as several recommendations to improve the program. In response to what I view as a very good report by the Legislative Auditor, Representative Dill and Senator Saxog asked the Department of Revenue, the Department of Natural Resources, and the Minnesota Forest Resources Council, the council that I serve as executive director, to convene a stakeholder group to respond to the auditor's report. This stakeholder group met several times during 2014 to seek agreement on how best to implement the auditor's recommendation. If you look on page 9, Appendix 1 of the stakeholder report, there's a list of who these stakeholder group members were, and you'll see it was quite a diverse group. Included a number of folks from Minnesota Forest Industries. Mr. Wayne Brand is here, just getting up in the back there, as one of the members of the group, and a number of his members served as well from several different forest products companies and other interests that he represents. Paul Cummings from the Department of Revenue, who's also with us today, and one of his former colleagues, and the Aitkin County Assessor, Mike Dangers, a couple representatives from the Department of Natural Resources, one of whom is with us today, as well as Forrest Bowe, the Director of Natural Resources, a couple of university representatives, myself and one of my staff from the Minnesota Forest Resources Council, representative of the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, Kim Scott from the Nature Conservancy, and then Kevin Wally, who's here today, one of his colleagues from the Minnesota Forestry Association, which represents the family forest landowners, the smaller acreage landowners in the state. So it's quite a diverse group, very many different opinions on various issues. We were asked to convene this group and see what kind of agreement we could reach on the auditor's recommendations regarding the SFIA. So I'm pleased to report that we reached quite a lot of agreement on the auditor's recommendations. In fact, the report that you have in front of you is in very close agreement with the auditor's recommendations. And I'm not going to take the time to repeat all the details. It's laid out on pages 3 through 9 of this report, particularly recommendations 1 through 7 on pages 3 through 8 of the report are very closely aligned with what you've just heard from the legislative auditor. And we have broad agreement by the stakeholders on the ways to implement those recommendations. I do want to mention recommendation 2, however, on page 4, which I think goes a little beyond what the auditor recommended and is significant. It, on the bottom of page 4, recommendation 2 from our stakeholder report says, identify the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act as an incentive program rather than as a tax program. This would clarify the intent and allow a shift in much of the administration of SFIA from the Department of Revenue to the Department of Natural Resources. Implementation of this recommendation is contingent upon Department of Natural Resources receiving adequate funding to carry it out. And that's an important statement that was put in there at the request of the Department of Natural Resources. But I think that is really an important recognition. I think the Department of Revenue was quite receptive to this idea. I think that's fair to say. Yes? And Department of Natural Resources, contingent on that last statement there, was willing to entertain this as well. There's broad agreement, as I said, on these recommendations. As stated in the footnote on the bottom of page 3, however, when I emphasized Departments of Revenue and Natural Resources, though they participated in the working group meetings and they provided background information, they did not take a position, a formal position on the recommendations. And they're here today, and I'll let them speak for themselves. Okay, the rest of the stakeholders there in broad agreement on particularly recommendations 1 through 7. I want to mention that Kevin Lally from the Minnesota Forestry Association has worked with Wayne Brandt from Minnesota Forest Industries and other stakeholders to develop a draft bill that incorporates both the legislative auditor's major recommendations and the stakeholder group's recommendations, particularly recommendations 1 through 7 from this stakeholder report. Talking with Mr. Wally and Mr. Brandt right before this hearing, they said, told me this bill would be ready for presentation to either this taxes committee here or the property tax division, chaired by Representative Biskowski, within the next few days at your request. You know, they could present their bill. And with that, I would stand for any questions that you have. Just recognize there's a lot of other folks who you might want to ask questions of that are here with us today.
I really don't want to. could we please have Mr. Nobles and Ms. Meyerhoff come back? And Mr. Zemeta, please stay.
I'll stay.
Please stay. Chair Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering, is there any, I think there are some programs that we have where you can get out of it, but you have to pay a penalty or something like that. But this one doesn't have any, the forest program doesn't have any way you can get out early and then pay a penalty or something or other.
Meyerhoff? Or Mr. Nobles?
Thank you.
Mr. Zemeta. Mr. Hines. Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, the Green Acres is the program that comes most to mind when you mention okay. that possibility. Under that program, there is no covenant that you sign, but you do have to pay back 2 years of taxes if you pull land out of that program. I could get more detail if you want, but that's
the gist.
Mr. Chairman, this plan doesn't have anything. You just got to wait 4 years and then another 4 years or whatever. That's your penalty.
Mr. Hines?
Okay.
Chair Earhart?
Thank you.
Okay. One, it kind of begs the question. I mean, I was reading through this report, and tie incentive payment to program goals or, and then the old shoe drops, repeal it. Mm-hmm. I think I'll talk to Representative Ansells before we think about those types of things and probably Representative Dill, but isn't that a bit harsh, Mr. Nobles? And I was just wondering, is this a precursor to the report for next week? You don't have to answer the second part.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
But it seems to me like it's kind of let's do all this stuff or just get rid of it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it was a way in which we tried to get the attention of the stakeholders and legislators, and I think we accomplished that. But we said it quite sincerely.
Yeah.
I mean, the government, as we all know, is often criticized for establishing programs and just putting them on automatic pilot. And, I mean, one of the reasons you created the Office of the Legislative Auditor was to go back every once in a while and take a look at a program that you created and ask fundamental questions. Is it effective? Can it be made more effective? Or do we need to just move on to something else? And, again, I think we covered the range of those possibilities. But more than anything, Mr. Chairman, I really appreciate, again, as I said in my opening statement, your attention and the attention of this committee and the working group. So I think we've accomplished what we set out to, and that is shining some light on this program and getting people to think about it and talk about it more critically than simply accepting, because it has a wonderful sounding name, that we all believe that it's doing what you intended.
Mr. Zemeta?
Mr. Chair, I just also respond. I think the legislative auditor did a very good job on this report. I don't view the recommendations as overly harsh, and I speak on behalf of a whole broad range of stakeholders in the forestry community. That's why you have an Office of Legislative Auditor, put out very good reports like this and call it like they see it.
What's your thought of the possible recommendation of a full repeal?
Mr. Chair, I think that would be a significant mistake in that many of your colleagues here, Representative Anzels comes to mind, but a lot of the others as well would find your phones ringing a lot more than they are right now by constituents who are adversely affected by the repeal of this.
Representative Loeffler and then Lanchester. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm someone who always values our forests and what they contribute to Minnesota in all kinds of different ways. But I have to say I'm really disappointed with the recommendation, as I understand it, of the stakeholder group, because Mr. Nobles just described the criticisms of the public that this is an autopilot kind of program with very little accountability. And when I look at the recommendations, and I think they can maybe be improved as they go through the process, mm-hmm. but I note on page 5 that adding complexity to the program that would burden state agencies should also be avoided. And then it continues on another page is saying, plan implementation monitoring. The big thing that you found was nobody's paying attention. Are these plans being implemented? Is the land being protected? Are the trees being preserved? Plan implementation monitoring could be accomplished through a checkbox annual report card or a phone call to a small percentage of the participants. You know, when someone gets 100% of their taxes paid out of a program, I think my constituents expect them to be a little more accountable than a checkbox or wondering if every 20 years or so they might get a phone call. And so, I mean, I really feel like we need to honor the work of our state auditor in raising legitimate issues. And I think there are ways to have a good, accountable program that achieves the goals that I think many of the forest property owners want to have. But I don't think this does. But we just had earlier, and I know some of you had a chance to hear the discussion on energy taxation. And on that, we talked about the public costs versus the benefits and, you know, what's a fair tax break. And I'm wondering if Mr. Nobles might relate that to this discussion in terms of I assume there are, or Mr. Zabata might even be more appropriate, there are public costs to these forest lands. They're relying on, you know, the local fire truck being available to run out when there's a fire. They haul their products on publicly maintained and authorized roads. And shouldn't forest lands contribute something? I mean, I don't mind giving people a reward for doing good things and sustaining our forests, but shouldn't there be some property taxes there to offset some of those public costs to those counties and townships that have those burdens?
Is this a problem? Who is that directed at?
Well, I think Mr. Zemeta actually would know more about what the public costs are related to these forest lands because he's more familiar with them.
Mr. Zemeta?
Representative Loeffler, Mr. Chair and committee members, are you asking me that the last question that you just asked?
Yeah, about is there public costs related to this, and should the counties and townships that are servicing these forest lands expect at least some property tax contribution to help with that?
Mr. Zemeta?
My personal view of that, if that's what you're asking me for, is I think the answer to that is yes. I think that, you know, counties incur substantial costs for providing fire protection, you know, police services, school bus services, and so on. A lot of other, you know, services. So there needs to be some kind of support, you know, for those local jurisdictions in providing those services. Now, that said, you know, one of the ways in which I've spoken with Representative Dill about this, with various other folks in the University of Minnesota, it seems to me, and I'm speaking just on behalf of myself personally here, okay, I want to qualify my remarks, but that we ought not be paying landowners more then they're paying in property taxes through a program like this. So, for example, in Coochaching County, one of the counties where the auditor's report found there's a lot of landowners getting you know, reimbursement through the SFIA that's greater than their property taxes, I think that ought to be revised so that doesn't happen. Okay? And that would be a reform that should be put into place as part of this. And I know Representative Dill's in agreement with that. And that we could do that. There's ways to do that in a fairly efficient way based on conversations we've had with Dr. Mike Kilgore at University of Minnesota, and folks in the Department of Revenue who are knowledgeable about this. In terms of the administration of the program, we have to recognize you have to do this in a way that keeps the costs at a reasonable level, both for the state agencies who are asked to administer it, and also for the local county, you know, the county assessors and the folks that have a hand in this at the local level. We want to keep government costs down for our counties and for the state agencies so they're at some reasonable level. So there's a balance to be struck between how much does a program like this cost and what are you getting in terms of the benefits from the program. And that's what we are trying to do through this stakeholder group process and in discussions with Department of Revenue and Department of Natural Resources. I think we've struck a reasonable agreement on that, and you know that's what's in the bill that we're talking about, you know, trying to bring forward.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know Mr. Zometa was just responding for himself personally, but I will just point out in the recommendation of the stakeholders on page 5, it says that a mechanism to make sure that the payments do not exceed property taxes would be an administrative burden that probably shouldn't be pursued, and I think that was my concern, is that I really do believe they do benefit from the county roads and a lot of other services, and I think it's a reasonable expectation that everybody pays something for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. I have Lincheski, Ansells, Hackbarth, and Earhart, but before we go there, tomorrow's meeting, we have two estate tax bills, Fisher and McDonald, and then we have a Knobloch local gaming bill, just so we know it's on the agenda for tomorrow. Chair Lincheski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, Mr. Chair, as you go forward and try to decide what to do about this program, because this report has been out for a little while, you know, I think about PILT as well. You know, these are programs that people will ask, why aren't they in the Environment Committee? Why is the Tax Committee dealing with them? And, you know, I think a look at the map might give a little insight as to why these things were created in Tax Committee. And I think they also might give a little insight to the likelihood of them leaving the Tax Committee. But it's been tried. I mean, I recall the PILT program was put under Speaker Kelleher. The account was carried in the Environment Committee, and Speaker Dowd had to make a decision on that. He could have made that decision on this account. And so speakers decide which committees they want to deal with what accounts, and so it's here now, and it could be changed by law. But I think it's instructive to think about in this program, you know, the value placed on the goal, and, you know, we haven't even talked about hunting and snowmobiles and, you know, public access for some of these lands, and I think that's a big part of it. I mean, there's definitely a benefit to Minnesotans to have access to some of these lands. But it was created as a property tax relief program. And I think, you know, you could, as the chair, think about what do you want it to be going forward? Do you want to repeal it? I mean, this is one of the most, you know, damning reports of all the things I've seen studied. I mean, it's really hard to argue that this program is just not a mess. And
Carolyn Chesky, you'll see another report next week.
Okay. That's even worse.
We'll see. I'm sorry. Sherilyn Chesky.
Okay.
To the floor.
But, you know, so this program, I mean, I think the reason it survives even a bad review, and I think it was in 2013 this came out, mm-hmm. is because, you know, there's a big benefit that's going on here, and we all have to care about it because all of our residents pay for it. It's a $44 million program that all citizens pay for. So it's a subsidy from the whole state going to these lands. And I think what's interesting to me, as I've thought about in the past, is that, you know, the biggest landholders you know, are getting a lot of this money, and what is the link to property taxes? And I just think those are just big policy questions. I mean, I couldn't figure out the answer, Mr. Chair, and I couldn't figure out how to get the Senate to want to make a change, and maybe you're going to be able to do that. But what I can say is I think what might give a little context, and maybe it's not a fair question to ask Mr. Michael and Mr. Hines right now, is just a little more history on how the program came to be, because it did start in the tax committee, and there was a major property tax reform. And if our nonpartisan staff could maybe just give legislators a little history on the creation of this program.
I think that's a good idea. My plan is to tie it somehow to Minnesota, Wisconsin tax reciprocity. Let's see. Mr. Michael, Mr. Hines. Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this program grew, as the auditor has pointed out of the 2001, you know, property or the tax bill, which was a major redo of the property tax system. And prior to this, there was and I will say that I did not do the staff work on this, but anyway, prior to the 2001 changes, there was a patchwork of special provisions for forest lands. We had a tree growth law, tax law. We had an auxiliary forest law. There was a forest management special classification and the basic timberland. There was a lot of unhappiness, I would say, in both the industry and with local assessors as to how those programs worked. And there was a desire on the part of those groups to essentially get beyond that patchwork of property tax programs that were, some of which were available in only some counties and others in not. There was a group that consisted of some people from the Department of Revenue, local assessors, and industry people that came back with this plan. And, of course, as you point out, it got also sort of mixed up with the issue of public access to this land, and the result of it was this program that I think it's fair to characterize as not really a tax program, but it has some other non-tax related goals. But it had the beneficial effect, I think, from the perspective of the tax community, of getting rid of this patchwork of programs to provide special treatment for forest lands, which I think by most accounts, you know, probably didn't accomplish much either and were inconsistent and so forth. And so that's, and I think, you know, the legacy of this, history defines a lot of the legacy of this program and how you deal with it.
Carolyn Chesky?
Oh, thank you.
Okay, members, do we have to be out here at noon? Or can we? Is there another committee?
Can I meet? Wait,
oh, absolutely. But I want to give ourselves a little more time if we can. Is there a 12:15 meeting in here?
12:45.
Okay. Because I know when I come into a room and it's not ready to go, I get a little cranky. So I don't want to do that. But let's go with Representative Ansells.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It really is appropriate to have a little balance here, I would argue. And I would argue that the public cost of chipping away at, I will agree, is that an assortment of programs and policies designed to provide Minnesota and the country with a sustainable, productive forest, which provides products and jobs and an economy, in particular in the top third of the state, is in the public interest. If you want to talk about public cost, it would be to let that forested area in the top third of the state go bad. And Representative Loeffler, preservation is not the word we use with regard to the management of this resource. This resource is a sustainable resource. It continues. It's not like mining, where you extract a mineral out of the earth and then it's forever gone.
these policies and this program contribute to the overall goal of managing the forest. If we don't manage the forest, we'll preserve it for a while, and then it'll all fall down.
Thank you.
Chair Hackbar.
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Brandt, did you want to say a few words? I think we can bring Mr. Brandt up. He's going to add some history to this program as well.
Okay, please state your name and who represents the record, please, and then put it on Turbo Boost.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Wayne Brandt, Minnesota Forest Industries, Minnesota Timber Producers, representing everywhere from truckers, loggers, forest landowners, sawmills, paper mills, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. For the Turbo Boost, I'd just point out a couple of things. This program is a payment program. Every property owner still pays their property taxes. That was one of the challenges in replacing the tree growth tax law was we all know property taxes are a zero-sum game. So if we're going to get a break, give a break to one set of taxpayers, somebody else has got to make it up. So the desire on the part of the counties in particular and the county auditors was to have it be a payment program to eliminate those inequities within the counties. As staff pointed out, it the reason it's in the tax bill is it was the successor to the tree growth and auxiliary forest laws. Tree growth was, I think, initially passed back in 1957, and you can go all the way back to the Constitution of the state, which has language about preferences for forest land activities. On the topic of, and I'm just kind of scattergunning here for the Turbo Boost, on the topic of
warp speed.
All right. On the topic of payments being greater than property taxes, that, you know, does occur in some areas in far northern Minnesota, but for the people I represent, they're getting no payment for providing the public access on these lands as required. If you have more than 1,920 acres, there's a variety of studies and real life transactions here in Minnesota that access is worth $10 to $50 per year. $10 to $50 per year, actual leases. So there's a lot of benefit that's being provided. And to Representative Anzell's point, I would say that when this was initially passed, there was a very impassioned speech that was made by a former Representative McElroy, who said at the time, and Representative Erickson remembers this, that, you know, he said, the northern Minnesota economy is based on timber, taconite, and tax transfers from the suburbs. And if you want to have fewer tax transfers from the suburbs, you need to have a viable industry up there so they can pay their own taxes and not ship it up from down here. So we would agree with that assertion, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Anzell?
Well, I'm ahead. I think I'm ahead.
I put down here Anzell's for president. So, Representative Earhart. Okay with that. And thank you, Chair Lincheski, for that was a good idea. Mr. Michael kind of give us kind of an outline of where we came from on all this. So, with that, 10:15 meeting tomorrow. Representative Hackbarth, you had the floor yet? Or are we okay? Okay. With that, good government all the time. We are adjourned.